This is the Stamfords podcast at the Stamfords Travel Writers Festival at Destinations in Olympia.
Welcome to the stage in conversation with Paul Blessard, Leon McCarron.
Oh, good Lord, that's loud. Good morning, everybody. Are you all well? Are you dry? Sore feet? Quite happy? How many of you have been to one of these events across the course of the last 2 days? I see some familiar faces in the crowd. For those of you who don't know, we are the travel writing festival embedded within Destinations, the exhibition that you're all here to see. And there are a range of events going over the course of the day. There's a program of events on the side of the booth behind you, so have a look and see what you fancy. Rick Stein's coming later on today if you fancy a bit of extreme cookery. Let me take this off. But we're delighted to start today's show with Leon. How many of you have either seen... Put your hands up if you've seen one of Leon's films. What is going on, sound people? And can we make it stop, please? Any of you seen any of Leon's films? Yep, a couple of hands up. How many of you have read his books, either about following the steps of Darwin along the Santa Cruz River in South America, walking across China? No? Some of you? Excellent. Well, you're in the right place. His latest book is called The Land Beyond, 1,000 miles on foot through the heart of the Middle East. So with the starting point of any good journey, sort of determines the journey. The starting point for our conversational journey today is a really simple question, Leon. Why this route, and why through the Middle East, and why at this time?
Sure, that's a good place to start.
It's three questions for the price of one.
Yeah, all in one. Good morning, everyone. Thank you for coming along. I think the Middle East is a fascinating part of the world. I'm from Northern Ireland, so it's not somewhere that I grew up particularly familiar with. But yet, the Holy Land has always felt like a place that's, at least culturally, I have some sort of reference point to. So I grew up knowing these names like Bethlehem and Jerusalem and Jericho and Nazareth and wondered what they might be like to see in real life and in a contemporary sense. And right now, I do everything on foot or by human power. I like to go slowly and to try and be able to immerse myself in places. And I just began to wonder, in a land that is being carved by footsteps and by the movement of people, would it be possible in this day and age for a foreigner from Northern Ireland to go and walk through the Holy Lands? And it's changing very rapidly. A lot of the big stories of our generation, it seems, are originating in the Middle East and spreading out and impacting across the world. So what would happen if I went there in person and explored it for myself? And that led me on this 1,000-mile trip.
Had you been there before? Did you have any experience of that part of the world, of the Middle East, of the Eastern and Mediterranean?
I'd travelled to the Middle East quite a few times before. I'd lived in Muscat in Oman for a short amount of time and studied a little bit of Arabic and become familiar with the Gulf area, and I'd been in the Persian world and other parts, northern Iraq and so on. But the Holy Land was relatively new to me, so it was a chance to go to the heart of it all, the holiest city in the world in Jerusalem and the place where a lot of this stuff comes from.
Quite. Let's do this question first of all, which is, you could do it a number of ways, and obviously all journeys have to have a start point. Where did you determine your start point to be, and what was the route that you were hoping to take, and why did you choose the route that you selected?
Well, I began in Jerusalem, and which seems like a very good place to go anyway. But as soon as I got to Jerusalem and told everyone I was heading off on a journey, they said, "That's stupid. You finish in Jerusalem. You end a pilgrimage in Jerusalem. You don't begin
exactly there,
you idiot." So that was an odd start.
But Richard the Lionheart need nothing to
exactly. But I chose Jerusalem because it was an easy place to begin, and it was right at the heart of the Israeli-Palestinian stuff. And I start with the big things first, and then work my way around. And you'll see what these are various pictures from the journey that'll just cycle around behind us as we speak. And one of those at some point will be a map of my route. And so you'll see the journey goes up through the West Bank, crosses into northern Jordan, into a place called Qais, which is right on the Syrian border, down the length of Jordan all the way through the middle of the country in the mountain range, across the Red Sea and across Sinai to finish at Mount Sinai. And so the symbolic start and end points were just the two places that I had heard of the most. And then at the end, I walked back through southern Israel to balance out some of that narrative, I guess, with adding an extra voice on the particularly complex geopolitical side of it as well.
Quite. What were your concerns before you left? Because, of course, with the press so determined to force us to understand anybody who wears one of these scarves or speaks Arabic or believes in Muhammad as being a threat, we miss the most important crucial thing, which is largely any Muslim, anybody who believes in Islam, has at the heart of them an acute sense of hospitality to strangers. And anything I've done in the Arab-speaking world, I have largely been dependent, whether it's cycling or walking through, on the hospitality of strangers, the incredible hospitality you were offered. Is that what you were expecting? What was your mindset before you set off?
It was what I was expecting, because I'd spent time there before, as you have, and yep. I suppose as many of you might have as well. But that was the working theory. It was, will this play out as I expect? And will I find that innate sense of hospitality that so many people have? And if I can find it, how can I therefore bring that back and share it as widely as possible? Because quite. It does feel like I write about this, I suppose, we live in a growing culture of fear and a fear of otherness and other people yep. and other ideas and particularly other religions. There's that us and them mentality is quite divisive. And to somehow focus in on the similarities that we have, commonalities around the world, and to celebrate differences rather than alienate them, it seemed like a worthy cause for a trip. And so it was really just to go and see what I could bring back on that topic.
So first few days of the walk, let's go through, because obviously there are so many stands here selling kit and selling the stuff you need for expeditions and for long travel, endurance travel, stuff like that. What sort of stuff do you take? Give us some practical details of what your pack list looks like.
Oh, gosh. So the only two things that are really important, if anyone would like to walk 1,000 miles in the Middle East, I can give you some advice. Get the best possible pair of walking boots that you can afford and wear them for at least 3 months before you go anywhere. Because if your feet aren't well looked after, the whole thing will be miserable. And you might have some great idea of a cultural exploration, but mostly you'll just be fixing blisters. So walking boots are very, very important.
There is a rather, I warn you now, for those of sensitive nature, there's a rather gruesome pair of feet photographed, which we'll cycle through shortly, which I think we all badly blistered feet.
It'll turn up, absolutely. Yep. And the other thing is a backpack, which is a similar yep. sort of theory. If the thing in which you're carrying your load is not very comfortable, then you're going to struggle. So I make sure that those are right, and then I just try and keep everything else as lightweight on the camping side and the logistical side. But it turns into a communications exercise, because I travel because I love these journeys and I love these places, but also because I want to share them and to write about them, but to make films about them. And I have a laptop and notebooks and audio recorders, and so that, oh, there's the feet. Make sure you get a good look at that before lunch.
And that's with a good pair of boots.
Yes, that's about 700 miles in. Most boot companies will tell you that their boots last for 1,000 miles or so, but that's not true. They last for about 300. So on a journey like this, you go through a number of pairs. Our packs were about 25 to 40 kilograms, depending on food and water, and that's much, much heavier than I would like.
That's 60 pounds plus. That's quite a weight.
60 to 80 pounds. And you've seen some of the more remote areas, some of these big, huge empty wadis and wilderness valleys, and those are where getting between water sources is very difficult. So you carry 10 liters of water with you and all of your food, and that adds to all the rest of the gear, and it can become quite miserable. But there's a point to the madness, I think. It gets you to the next place.
Slightly technical question, but you're carrying a laptop, you're carrying electronic kit. How do you keep things charged? Did you have a solar charge on the panel on the top of your pack? Or
I do, yeah. There's solar technology has advanced rapidly in the last few years, and as you know from doing long journeys where you're under your own steam, it used to be quite a challenge. Now there's I use a company called Power Traveler, and they have these little panels that are not much bigger than that the front side of that box, and that can power in 8 hours of daylight. That can power a laptop and a camera and an iPhone and a GPS, and you're all set.
It's much easier now than it was even 5 years ago, let alone 10. So you land in Jerusalem, you've got sorted out. Talk us through the first couple of days. What sort of response were you getting? Because as you write so elegiacally and so beautifully, walking is is the most fundamental means of travel that we as human beings have. There's something about traveling at that 3 miles an hour that allows you to engage not only with the ground under your feet, but the people you're meeting along the way. So talk us through the first couple of days.
Walking's a remarkable way to travel. It's very, it's the simplest thing that we can do, and it's something we've been doing all our lives, but when you use it to get you from one place to another, it suddenly seems to unlock all of these experiences that you might not have otherwise. And I'm under no illusion that when I go to places like this, or when any of us travel to somewhere foreign, we will always be an outsider and we'll only ever scratch the surface and get that little slice of life. But if you turn up in a Land Cruiser or a huge bus or step off a plane, somehow there's a more of a distance between you and whoever you might meet. If you turn up on foot and you're sweaty and you're carrying everything you need to survive in a backpack, it forms more of an intimate connection with the first person that you strike up a conversation with. And I find this on all of my journeys and this one particularly so. And Jerusalem at the time was very tense. It goes in these peaks and troughs of tension. And at the end of 2015, when I began, there'd been a spate of unrest. And so I left. There's a couple of pictures you might see of soldiers clustered around the holy sites in Jerusalem. And as soon as I walked out with my companion Dave on the first day and a couple of other friends, we walked into this beautiful empty valley called Wadi Kelt, which, if I see the picture, I'll point it out to you. Wadi Kelt is said to be the Valley of the Shadow of Death from Psalm 23, or from Pulp Fiction, depending on your cultural reference point. But it's the old Roman road runs along the top where the parable of the Good Samaritan set, where Jesus is said to have walked, and there's a 6th century monastery cut into the side of the cliff, and these old caves where hermit monks would have lived, and it's one of the most beautiful places I've ever walked, and it's the natural highway between Jerusalem and Jericho, and it's 2 hours walk away from the heart of this tension of the most intractable problem in the Middle East. And, you know, that's the beauty of just setting out on foot and seeing what you find.
And what sort of response were you getting from the people that you were walking alongside, settlements you were going through, homes you were walking past? People were encouraging, friendly, incurious, wondering who the hell you were?
Curious and bemused would be the first response. I think in the UK sometimes we can be quite closed emotionally, and if we see someone who looks strange or is doing something strange, we tend to look the other way to avoid embarrassment for everyone. In the Middle East and in much of the world, actually, that's not the case. When someone sees someone odd, such as me with my rucksack and my kind of sideways beard and unwashed, people would do the most natural thing in the world. They would point and laugh and wander over to me and sometimes go and get their family so they could also join in with the pointing and the laughing. And then they would say, how can we help? Come in and we'll look after you. And so they would bring me in. And I would find this all over. I consider this statement before I say it, but I did not find any resistance to my being there. It was various different levels of hospitality, from a kind of maybe slightly lukewarm welcome if someone wasn't quite sure what I was there, and that was very rare, but mostly right through to being offered to stay in someone's home for a week, and that was quite regular.
One of the things that I'm intrigued about by the photos is, of course, we think of the Middle East as being very populous, very heavily, densely populated, and of course that's true in so many of the urban areas. But the sense of wildness, of desolation, of it being you, man, on this land, comes across clearly through your writing and through the pictures. Can you give us a sense of how wild it feels when you are there?
The experience changes all of the time. It does have these huge, sprawling cities, mega cities, Jerusalem and Amman and places like that. But in between those are these great empty areas, and in the north of Jordan and in the northern part of the West Bank, it can be very green and fertile, and again, not what many people might expect from the Middle East. But then in the southern part, you have Wadi Rum and the Sinai, and these huge empty deserts. And I like that experience of being able to have both. This very binary experience of walking. And I think when I write about it, there's more to be said for places that we don't know that much about. That's the experience I'm interested in as a travel writer, is what what can I bring that's new? I don't want to write about the same places and the same experiences that everyone else has written about because it's been done so beautifully and so wonderfully in the past. And often it's those wild, empty parts or relatively sparsely populated places that haven't been spoken about so much, and it's times with Bedouin families in the desert south of Petra that are perhaps the most interesting or novel to my mind.
There's another thing that springs to mind, of course. We see the lines on the map that delineate national borders, so transitioning from Jordan to Petra to Israel to Palestine. But when you're on the ground, it's just terrain. Did you ever get a sense that you're transitioning from, oh, this is Jordan now, obviously, or this is Palestine now, obviously, or is it just country and it just fits?
Actually, it's not, and that's something that surprised me, because another beauty of walking, this whole event is essentially my pitch to you to go walking, because I think it's such a great way to travel, and I really enjoy everything about it, but you move so slowly. You move at 3 miles an hour. Mind and body move at 3 miles an hour as you're traveling. And things change you gradually that you don't necessarily notice you're in a completely new landscape or environment. Yep. Except in the Middle East, where there are these very, very definitive borders and boundaries. And of course, crossing out of Palestine into Israel, you go past this separation barrier or wall or fence or whatever we may call it, and it is the most obvious of physical boundaries, and the same getting across into Jordan. From Israel into Jordan, I would cross the Jordan River, which sounds wonderfully romantic. I was very excited about it, and I had these visions of myself striding down to the banks of the River Jordan and kind of bathing myself and going across. And of course, it's a military zone. If you tried that, you'd be shot immediately by two different international countries. And instead, you have to get on a bus. So I had to break my line of unbroken footsteps and get on this little bus for about 300 meters, and it goes across the river. And the river itself is about this wide. You could jump over it if you were allowed. Those do break it up. The land doesn't change. The people don't change. It still works. I mean, some of the Bedouin tribes are still spread across all of these places. But we, as a human race, have built these very arbitrary
and artificial and destructive borders
in quite a lot of this region.
Exactly. One of the things I was intrigued about to read in this, which may surprise people, is this new development. And I don't know how advanced it is now, that they are setting up official hiking trails through a lot of this terrain. Can you talk us through this?
Yep. So this is one of the most exciting parts of the journey for me. In previous journeys, I've done quite a lot, reasonable amount of long walking journeys before, and I've never had a trail to walk on. I've just walked and asked people which way to go, and that's certainly got its pros. But here I found when I was planning that in the West Bank and Jordan and Sinai, there are organizations who are trying to build recreational hiking trails to the sort of model of the Camino de Santiago or the Appalachian Trail or the PCT or some of these other long-distance hiking trails. It's different because it's the Middle East.
So PCT, Pacific Coastal Trail.
Pacific Crest Trail.
Crest Trail, forgive
yes,
me. Okay.
Yeah, so that's the West Coast one, and the Appalachians on the East. And it's a very audacious plan, and I think it's going to take quite a bit of time, but they're really growing. And when I was there was still quite a bit of work to do, but in the last couple of years, they've developed hugely. So if any of you wanted to, you could go and find GPX tracks to walk through Jordan on these trails that take you through Bedouin communities and into cities and out into the wilderness and so on. And hopefully that's a way. That's the latest iteration of people walking on this, from the old trade routes to the armies to the pilgrims to the Bedouin to now potentially modern day hikers, that next layer of people walking on this land.
Is there a name for these trails? Is there a website that people can go to? How developed, how advanced is it?
Yes, so two of them are very simple. In Jordan, it is called, the trail in Jordan is called the Jordan Trail. That's an easy one to remember. The trail in Sinai is called the Sinai Trail. And the trail in Palestine is not called the Palestinian Trail because that's too complex. It's called the Masar Ibrahim, which is means the path of Abraham.
The Masar Ibrahim.
Masar Ibrahim.
Okay.
But if There's links to all of them on the website, which is around my book, which is not just an advert. It is also an advert for my book. But thelandbeyondbook.com has got links to all of these, and then you can go through to the websites for the trails and plan your walk.
And would you advise people, and people are here sort of looking at potential holidays, looking at potential vacations over the next sort of 12 months or so, that's why they're here in this exhibition, would you recommend people do it? And you're an extreme traveller, you've done tough stuff. But for somebody that's got a day job, has 4 weeks holiday a year, and might want to spend 2 weeks walking through somewhere in the Middle East to go and see Petra, go and see Jerusalem, would you advise them to do so?
I would, and I don't say that lightly. I've thought quite a lot about that. All of these places are fine to go and walk in. Certainly, security-wise, safety-wise, they're absolutely fine. You, as with any parts of the world, you need to do due diligence and make sure that there's no volatility at that particular time. But it's fine. I actually led a hiking trip with 10 guests in the West Bank last November, and it was beautiful. And I think Jordan is probably the easiest of all these places. It is removed slightly from some of those other questions and complexities, but Sinai is a very different experience. If you were to go there, you can have some Bedouin and a camel accompany you, and the camel can carry all of your gear. And so all of these places are not just possible, but I would say very, very appealing to travel to for anyone, and not just someone who likes some more of the extreme side, like me, because you can wander along at 5 or 10 miles a day and spend the entire time eating hummus and wonderful food and come back.
You've sold it to me. I'm booking up shortly.
Yeah, it's great.
Well, we were talking about geopolitics and I don't want to labour it too much, but how did that have any impact at all on the walk that you did in terms of the people you were talking to? Were they keen to talk about what was going on in the region, whether from the Israeli side or whether from the Palestinian side, or was that not part of it at all?
It was part of it. It's such a big part of people's lives, and more so in Israel and Palestine than in Jordan and Sinai. And it's another great thing about travelling slowly rather than rushing through places, is that both on the Israeli side and the Palestinian side, I would find that the first hour of any conversation I would have with almost anyone would be about the situation, the geopolitics. Right. They would essentially pitch me their viewpoints and explain to me why they felt the way they did. And if I'd been traveling through in some other means of transport, or if I was in a rush or beholden to a schedule, that's all I would have heard. But with more freedom of walking slowly and taking your time, I could spend 6 hours, 7 hours, a whole night with people. And once you get past that top level, then people begin to talk about the things that are really important to them. And I don't mean this to downplay the complexities there, but people would start to talk about music and poetry and food and family and the things they love to do in their spare time. And more so than anything else, what I realized is that's what defines people. Yeah. Conflict doesn't define people. Being in the midst of all of this isn't the personalities of who we meet, and it's really nice and important to try and get to what's really there, the heart of it all.
Fair enough. I want to do a little bit of a voyage around you, because you've done so many extraordinary things, and you have some fantastic reviews on the back of your book, which I'll read out towards the end after you had questions from the audience. But what took you, a guy from Northern Ireland, out into the world with the conscious decision that you are going to retrace some of the great journeys, from Darwin on the Santa Cruz to wanting to walk across you walked across China, walked across the Gobi Desert, lots of stuff. Talk us what inspired you to be the adventurer that you are, and then we'll talk about the writing bit, how that came into it.
Sure. I think like many modern day adventurers, my story began with unemployment. I couldn't get any other
That's
sort of
honest.
A job. I went to university for a few years and kind of graduated into recession time, and I'd done an arts degree combining English and film and media, and so I was thoroughly unsuited for any sort of real life job, and I found it very stressful at the time, and I had this impression that at a young age I needed to know what I was going to do with the rest of my life, and I couldn't figure it out. So I saved up for a year and set off on what I thought would be a one-off adventure. I would just go and do something once that I could be very proud of when I got older. I could look back on this great thing. And so I combined a very long list of things that I was interested in with a very short list of things I was good at, and had this simple, ambitious plan to cycle around the world. Right. And so I started from New York City, and I was terrible at it, and I got lost, and I had too much gear, and 2 years later, I'd figured it out, and I ended up riding 14, 15,000 miles, and
I'd completely forgotten that was how you started. You'd done
that was how I started on a bicycle.
On bicycle, of course.
Yes, and it was superb. But a bicycle is just such a great rite of passage journey, but I did that for me. I was just this thing that I was very grateful to have had the opportunity to do, and I assumed I would go home and rejoin normal life, like all of my normal friends, towards the end of that trip, I started writing about it and realized that I had just as much interest in, if not more, in sharing what I found, and by virtue of being on bicycle, I was in unusual places.
Yeah.
And I wondered if I could turn that into something more, so I submitted stories to local newspapers back in Ireland, and when I finished that trip, started planning a new one with a little bit more of a focus, and then over the last 7 or 8 years, I've just
built on from
just
there.
Kept going on those trips.
Tell us a little bit about the Santa Cruz Darwin trip, how that came about.
So in 2014, I followed the Santa Cruz River, which is the last large free-flowing glacial river in Argentine Patagonia. I followed it on horseback from the Atlantic Ocean through to the Andes. And it's this beautiful river in this kind of very sparse, empty wilderness. And I'd always had in my mind that the two great wildernesses in the world, and this is potentially not true, but in my mind it was, that the two great wildernesses left were Mongolia and Patagonia. Right. And I'd walked across the Gobi Desert in Mongolia on part of my China journey, and so I wanted to follow this on horseback. And as I was looking at that, just as a wilderness journey, essentially, I found that river was due to have two enormous mega dams built on it that would completely destroy the ecosystem. They may affect the glaciers, the Perito Moreno Glacier, which is very important at the far end, and they were being built with $5 billion of Chinese investment, which was the largest Chinese investment in Latin America at the time, and they were due to be built imminently. So I, within about 5 weeks of realizing that, I began the journey. Very minimal preparation time, but I figured that it may well be, and it turned out to be, the last documentation of the river before before it got destroyed.
And how did the filmmaking come about? Because you made films from National Geographic to all sorts of people. How does making a film about the journey while you're on the journey change the journey for you? Because then you're having to think with a different, completely different headset, mindset, from just walking 3 miles an hour, day in, day out, enjoying the route and thinking about how you're going to write it. Film's a very different medium, obviously.
Yeah, well, as you will know, and as many of you will know as well, when you're doing something that's very exciting to you and you're on a journey or traveling somewhere, the more you try to document it, the more it removes you from the experience of being in this place that you want to be in. And it's taken me a few years to get it right. Honestly, I have, on many journeys, including this one, been both taking notes for a book and trying to take good photographs and also trying to film enough that I can put together some sort of end product from it. And the filming is the hardest because you have to, if you're a one-man camera crew, as I've been so often in the past, you have to walk over here and set up a tripod and put the camera on and press record and check the sound levels and then walk back into shot and make sure you're standing where you thought you were standing and the person you want to interview walks over there and you have to go over there and get them and say, no, you have to stand here because it's very important. And they say, well, what? And that's 30, 40 minutes just of setting things up. And it's very difficult. So I'd still enjoy the process of it, but it's a very fine balance in getting it right. And
does it get in the way? Does it?
It does get in the way. I always have to try and do this equation in my head as to whether or not it's worth it. And it always is, because if I was just doing these things for my own benefits, I would very much enjoy them, but I wouldn't be able to share these things. And sure. I think there are important messages from these journeys. So it is worth it because of that, but I do miss out on some of the experience. And I make sure I build in days or potentially just other shorter journeys in which I leave everything behind and don't document or record or tell anyone about it at all. It's just for me to be in this place that I'm very fond of.
It's an important part for a travel writer, though, because in the same way that you can't step into the same river twice, you can't walk the same journey twice. In each document you make of each walk, documents that walk at that period of time, and it's never going to be the same again, especially in the world changing as quickly as it is at the minute. One last question for me, and then we'll open to the floor. What are you doing next? What's your next travel? What's your next plan? Can you tell us?
I can sidestep your question with a bit of clarity. I've ended up spending a lot of time in the Middle East recently, both before and during and now after this trip, and I've just come back from the Kurdistan region in northern Iraq, which is another one of these wonderfully central focal points that so many old trade routes and stories and key parts of world history have gone through, and it's got its own issues right now, but it's a fascinating place. So I spent a month there over Christmas and New Year, and I've done some shorter stories from there, but I'm hoping that developed into something bigger. And then I've concretized a concept for a new journey in the last couple of days, and I'm not going to tell you because I don't want to. But
tell us a continent.
Multi-continent.
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 Okie dokie.
But I think it might work. I'll be excited to share it with you when I'm convinced it's actually a good idea.
Inshallah. Perhaps you'll come back next year and tell us about it.
Yeah.
Guys, it's your time to ask Leon your own questions, if you have them, about walking or the Middle East or anything. We'll start with the gentleman there who was first, and then we'll come to the lady there. Please, sir.
Global talk. When you went to...
Can you hold it a little closer to your mouth so we can hear you?
Oh, there you go. When you went to Sinai, did you go up Mount Sinai? And how did that sort of rate as an experience? I did it in 2013, and it's one of the best walks I've ever done.
Yeah, it's beautiful. Did everyone hear the question?
Just repeat it.
Yeah. So the question was about traveling through Sinai, and did I climb Mount Sinai at the end? And I did, absolutely. That was the symbolic endpoint of my journey, was on the summit. And it's a fascinating place. This journey for me wasn't a religious pilgrimage. I was very interested in how all of these Abrahamic religions come together, but it certainly wasn't ostensibly a way for me to have some sort of spiritual experience. But I find that in places like that, in Jerusalem and on the top of Mount Sinai, you feel the weight very palpably of all of that energy that's brought other people there. And any place which brings so many people who believe in something so strongly, it leaves a mark on a place. And Mount Sinai is one of those areas. And the top also has a church and a mosque built side by side, which is one of these other wonderful examples of the cooperation in a land that we're often told is divided along religious lines. It's not always the case. So I very much enjoyed it. Thank you for asking.
Lady there had a question.
Did you observe or hear much about climate change? I'm thinking of the nomadic tribes. And also, do you carry more than one pair of warning boots? Do you wear several pair of boots in before you start?
Good questions, both.
Yeah, very good. I'll start with the second one. No, it's a very good idea. It's on the long list of things that I plan to do on a journey and never get around to, is to wear in boots so they're ready to go. And I don't carry a second pair. I just end up getting the same brand and model sent out, and then there's a couple of days of slight misery as the boots form to my feet, and then generally things are okay. And by that point, your feet are like leather anyway, so it's not so bad. Climate change, I mean, yes, absolutely. Anywhere in the world, I think anecdotally you find examples of this, and if you pile all of those anecdotes on top of each other, you start to have something that I think is probably quite telling. All of them were on quite a small scale in the journey I was in, but everyone has stories of how, even in the last 10, 15 years, the weather patterns have changed, and particularly the nomadic tribes are moving to different areas of pasture because where they were previously is no longer suitable. And so it's obvious, and it is already affecting people's lives and is causing people to move. And of course, that's the big concern for all of us, is what happens once climate change starts causing mass migration across the earth, and it's happening there as well.
Good question. Who else? Yes, please, over here. And then we'll come to the gentleman there. Thank you.
Hi. I just wondered whether you had any advice for aspiring travel writers.
Advice for aspiring travel writers.
Oh, maybe you can help with this as well.
Do you want me to?
Yes, if you...
I can give you a piece of advice. The Edward Stanford Travel Writing Awards... If you look up Edward Stanford Travel Writing Awards, started a program 2 years ago where people that write a travel blog can submit a 700 to 800 word piece that will then get voted on by a panel of judges, people from the literary world, people from the travelling world, people like myself. And the gentleman who won 2 days ago, it was his first attempt. He'd been forced to submit it because he'd been on a trip. His family said, you should put it forward. And he won a Globe Award, exactly the same as was won by Michael Palin the year before. So that I would pitch that to you. There may be some information at the back. If not, go and have a chat with Stanford's, or I'll see you around the back and I'll introduce you to the managing director. He'll talk you through it. That's point one. Point two, for anybody else, we live in a world where there's a wonderful thing. It's called the internet. You can set up a blog on any number of platforms and you can just work and work and work at your writing. And you put it out there, and the better you get, the more attention your blog will get. And that's when you know you're getting it right. In terms of actual writing and what good travel writing should be, if you want the baseline notes, Leon, because he's very good at it, what would you say a good piece of travel writing should include at the very base?
I think I mentioned it earlier. It's always, you want to bring people with you wherever you're going, and so you want to somehow convey that sense of that place in a way that both has a unique voice and will make people want to come back to your writing, but also that makes whoever's reading it feel very much that they are there. And so to somehow offer something new in the pantheon of travel writing, which I'm aware is not a small task. But the only other thing I would say is all the writing I've done came from forcing myself to write repeatedly. Writing is like any other skill or muscle. You just work it and work it and work it until it's better and better and better. And I would just send it everywhere, from these newspapers in Ireland to starting my own blog and gathering clippings and gathering a portfolio until I could say, I've been published here, and go to the next person, the next person, the next person, until I eventually, after about a year and a half, I got paid £13.50 for my first written piece. So it's still not lucrative, but it works.
It's a good point you raise, actually. If you want to make your money from travel writing, that's a tougher ask. But I'll come back to the first things. If you want, just because you own a pen does not make you a writer. In the same way that just because you own a violin does not make you Yehudi Menuhin. What makes you a writer is the practice, the practice, the practice, the practice, the practice. If you want to make money from it, read the best of travel writing you can possibly find. Whether it was Christopher Hitchens writing for Vanity Fair 10 years ago about doing Route 66, one of the finest pieces of travel writing of that time ever, to anything that's on sale in Stanford's now, to any of the travel articles that you read in any of the newspapers that still do travel articles, to reading National Geographic, stuff like that. If you want to be the best and to make money from the thing that you want to do, read the people who are already doing it, so you know what people are paying for, what editors are paying for. And then, as Leon said, just pull up a list in the... there's a thing called... it's probably online now, but I still go hard copy. The Artists and Writers Yearbook. Mm. Artists and Writers Yearbook. Go there. It lists every publication in the UK that will do travel. You have to figure out which ones do travel, which are not. Make a list of all the editors and the sub-editors and all that sort of stuff. Put them in an address book on your laptop. Every time you write a piece that you are happy with, that you've written at least 10 times before you've even sent it out, then send it out and see what feedback you get. I think that's probably the best advice, not just to you, but to anybody who writes. I mean, we all write emails from wherever we are now to our family. That's travel writing. It's building on that. Sorry. Gentleman here had a question. So sorry.
Thank you. Did you find the problems that's happening in Syria are still affecting the northern part where you were travelling? Is that something that you still found people talking about, like any of the migration or anything like that?
Yeah, so the question was about the ongoing civil war in Syria and the impact that might have had on some of the journey in general, but particularly the northern areas. Absolutely, and Jordan is the safe haven. It's seen as the safe haven in this volatile region, but particularly so it's a place of refuge as well. And there are now, I guess, best estimate is over 1 million Syrian refugees in Jordan. That's 1 in 9 people in the country. And so any journey to Jordan, but particularly so one on foot, you see a lot of Syrians, and they've arrived and have assimilated in a variety of ways. I'm not sure, I don't think the picture's in this slideshow, but I would see a lot of those white UNHCR, the UN Refugee Agency tents that would just be pitched by the side of the road, and that's the newest arrivals. People would simply just be living out of this single
windy tents and trying to figure out what to do next. But there are many Syrians who are now in the big cities and of making a new life. So it very much impacts on a journey. And of course, there's the big camps, like the Zaatari refugee camp was on my route as well. And it's still ongoing, of course. And that border is still porous between Jordan and Syria.
I think, as Leon said, you know, check Foreign and Commonwealth Office advisories before you travel. But bear in mind, when you know, you can, we're 4 hours away from the nearest war, and when you fly there, the war can be three streets away, and you can be having a fantastic coffee or an incredible cultural exchange with somebody, and it's just there. You know, as I found when I flew to Rwanda in '94. Do we have time for one last quick question? And it's going to go to the gentleman. Would you wait for the microphone, please, sir? Sorry, so everybody can hear you. Thank you.
The journey itself took between 5 and 6 months.
Yeah. 1,000 miles.
1,000 miles, yeah, between 5 and 6 months. So it wasn't a particularly fast walking journey.
May I ask you a very nosy question?
Had
to just brush away.
Yes,
how
yes.
do you fund it?
Oh, yeah,
to
very
six
good
months
question.
Away from home when you need to travel, feed yourself, all that sort of stuff. That's a lot of money.
It is, yeah. So most of my journeys, my earlier journeys, were all self-funded. And I always think, I use the example of I went to Iran to follow the longest river, the Karun River in Iran.
Yeah.
And it took me 6 weeks to get from one end to the other. And that whole journey, including all the on-the-ground costs, plus my flights, plus buying these little inflatable boats that we used, it cost £750 each to do this journey that we turned into a film and were able to write about, and I built quite a lot of my career on that trip. So a lot of my journeys used to cost very, very little. This one cost a little bit more because I wanted to put some money into the local economy and to hire guides and translators and fixtures and so on. And I searched around for funding from grant programs from places like the Royal Geographical Society. And also, this one, I found a non-profit organization called the Abraham Path Initiative, who do peace building through things like walking, through looking at another side, another narrative to a misunderstood part of the world.
Good point. The old adage applies. Time spent on reconnaissance, never time wasted. How many people are thinking about heading towards the Middle East this year for a trip, whether to Jordan or Petra? Oh, good few of you. Excellent.
Good,
yeah. Well, hopefully we've given you some ideas. If you need some ideas for some decent reading before you go, I can commend this. And if you need any help, if you need any further encouragement, can I just say Ranulph Fiennes wrote this about this book. A marvellous adventure and an impressive feat of endurance. This is also a journey that explores the people and landscapes of a misunderstood part of the world with great insight and enthusiasm. Have you heard of a man called Benedict Allen? He wrote this: informed, engaging, and sensitive, Leon makes the perfect companion for the dusty road. Ladies and gentlemen, Leon McCarron.
Thank you.